It's basically a warning to computer scientists that you should not ignore physics, because ultimately the fundamental limits on, you know, what we can compute, what kinds of cryptographic schemes and communication schemes we can have, is determined by our best physical theories, because that's what determines the functioning of the devices that we use to implement that. But there's sort of a complementary slogan that physics is informational, and I interpret that as meaning essentially that it's useful to take an information theoretic perspective on problems in physics. And that if you do that, you can sort of get a new understanding of physical theories, and possibly this might lead to some sort of new and transformative developments in physics. So this talk is all about that second slogan. And I'm gonna try to convince you that, you know, information theory, you shouldn't think of it as like plumbing and irrelevant to physics, but rather something that's instead sort of at the very foundation, and that we should be thinking more about information theory and applying it to our physical theories. So to tell you a bit about how I sort of view the connection between information theory and physics, I want to contrast two notions of revolutions in physics. So the first notion is sort of the standard notion of a revolution. So this is the idea of a theory that, you know, comes along and it supplants the theory that came before it, its predecessor, by making some new prediction that contradicts the old one and then being empirically verified. And those are typically sort of dramatic events that happen. You know, you can sort of pinpoint when it happened. But there's a different kind of revolution which happens a lot more slowly. And it's more the flavor of sort of slowly changing your perspective on an existing physical theory without necessarily overthrowing it anyway. So these are a few historical examples. So the first one, the use of least action principles, the work of Hamilton and Lagrange didn't overthrow Newtonian mechanics. It sort of left it intact, but it significantly changed our perspective on what the theory was. It broadened the scope of applicability of the theory, and it certainly paved the way for the theories that came after Newtonian mechanics and rejected it. Another example would be the use of symmetry principles in physics. So Enrico Fermi once said that prior to Einstein's work, symmetries were sort of inferred from our physical theories. And post-Einstein's work, symmetries were sort of built in at the ground level. You know, you start a theory by saying what its symmetry should be and then, you know, deriving from there. Another good example of, you know, a constraining principle on what our theory should look like is the second law of thermodynamics. And there's this really nice quote by Eddington. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but I'm just going to read it out because I like it. So if someone points out to you that your pet theory of the universe is in disagreement with Maxwell's equations, well then so much the worse for Maxwell's equations. And if it's found to be contradicted by observation, well, these experimentalists do bungle things sometimes. But if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. And I think most physicists sort of agree that, you know, your theory should at least do justice to the second law of thermodynamics. So I claim that somehow these principles were sort of useful in coming up, ultimately leading to the first sort of revolution. So let me give a bit of evidence for that. So if you look at the dawn of quantum theory, you find that action principles actually played a big role, because de Broglie was thinking about the analogy between Fermat's least action principle in optics and Maupertuis's least action principle in mechanics. And he basically noticed that ray optics was just an approximation to deeper wave theory, and thought, well, if the analogy holds, then mechanics should be an approximation to a deeper wave theory. Thermodynamics principles were obviously important in the work of Planck and Einstein when they proposed the notion of the quanta. In the context of relativity theory, you know, Einstein used the invariance of physical laws for different inertial reference frames and general covariance in the context of general relativity. And even in sort of modern field theories, as I said, you know, symmetry principles are built in from the ground floor. And you know, QED, for example, made heavy use of action principles in the form of Feynman's reformulation of quantum theory in terms of path integrals. So the idea that I want to propose is that we should think of information theoretic principles in a similar way. So they're going to change our perspective on existing physical theories, I think, in the near future. And maybe on a longer time scale, the new perspective we gain from information theoretic principles might ultimately pave the way for something more to come. So I think that currently we are sort of in the very beginning stages of a slow revolution wherein we are going to reconceive essentially all of physics from a kind of information theoretic perspective, And in some places, it's going to give us some new insights. So the evidence that information theory is actually useful, I think the invasion is happening on many fronts. And one place where it's clearly having a huge impact is in the foundations of quantum theory. So I would say the last 20 years or so has been a sort of renaissance in quantum foundations because of new ideas that come from quantum information theory. And personally, so there's been a lot of impressive work on information theoretic principles for deriving the formalism of quantum theory. And I believe that that's because ultimately quantum theory is a theory of information, that it's a theory that observers should use when they have incomplete knowledge of the world. But I'm not going to tell you anything about that story today. So instead, I'm going to try to make the case by showing you the significance of information theoretic principles for other sorts of principles, so in particular for symmetry principles and thermodynamic principles. So Noether's theorem and the second law of thermodynamics in particular. Okay, so to do that, I'm going to need to sort of tell you a bit about a framework for studying symmetries and thermodynamics, which is the framework of resource theories. So the best way to explain this is to use perhaps the best known modern example of a resource theory, which is entanglement theory. So if you look at the history of entanglement, the term was coined in the mid-30s by Schrodinger, but it wasn't until the mid-90s that the theory really started to take off and developments started happening really rapidly. And what changed was that in the mid-90s, people suddenly started thinking of entanglement as a resource. It was realized that there was various tasks for which entanglement could help you. And then people started trying to quantify it and study it as a resource. And so in particular, it was found that if Alice and Bob are kind of constrained in their abilities, so they can do quantum operations in their local labs, but they only have a classical channel between their labs, then they can't prepare entangled states. And it was found that you can use an entangled state to simulate one use of a quantum channel. And so you consume the entangled state. At the end, it's gone, but you manage to send quantum information from Alice to Bob. So it manages to essentially lift the restriction that Alice and Bob were suffering from. And so it's a resource. And so from that point onwards, people actually started rethinking entanglement, and it ultimately became defined as that thing which you cannot prepare if you only have access to local operations and classical communication. And then the game became, what's the amount of entanglement of different states? Well, you sort of want to know, can I go from this entangled state to that entangled state? And the rules of the game are, I'm allowed to use local operations and classical communication as much as I like. So I can do as much classical communication. There's no limit to that. That part of it is all free. Those are the free operations. And anything else is a resource. And we want to know what the structure is on the set of resources given unlimited access to the free operations. So that's the general structure of a resource theory. So the sorts of questions you can answer in these theories, I've just put a few on this list. So I think one of the most primary questions is what are the necessary and sufficient conditions under which one state can be converted to another deterministically by the free operations? Then you can ask, what if you only want the final state to arise with some probability? What's the optimal probability for that to happen? What are the conditions under which it can happen? What about if you allow a catalyst? So that's the idea of a state which is itself a resource, but it doesn't get consumed. So it just facilitates the conversion of resource one to resource two without being consumed. And entanglement theory, for example, having an entangled state as a catalyst can help to make certain transitions possible. Another very basic question is, if instead of having a single copy of a resource, you have arbitrarily many copies, and you want to know at what rate can I convert it into arbitrarily many copies of another resource? Then you can ask, is it the case that all resources are interconvertible in this asymptotic limit? One of the most useful questions to answer is, can you define measures of this resource? So measures of entanglement, for example, which resource is stronger than which other? And then finally, a more refined sort of question would be, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions under which some resource state can simulate some resource transformation? So the example of entanglement being used to simulate a use of a quantum channel is an example of that sort of thing. So the two resource theories I'm going to talk about are, first, the resource theory of asymmetry. So that's the resource there are quantum states that break some symmetry. And the second is what I call the resource theory of athermality. And there, the resource is quantum states that are out of thermal equilibrium, non-equilibrium quantum states. And there's been a lot of work done on both those theories in the last 10 years. And effectively, all of these questions have been answered in certain regimes. So it's a bit like entanglement theory. So in entanglement theory, we have a good handle on pretty much all these questions for the case of pure bipartite entanglement. But when you go to multipartite or mixed state entanglement, then we have less insight. And it's similar for the two I'm going to tell you about. So in the context of asymmetry, we have a good handle in the case of pure states. In the case of mixed states, there's more open questions. And in the case of athermality, we have a good handle on the case of quasi-classical states, which are those that commute with the Hamiltonian. So I won't have time today to tell you about all these details. I'm going to focus just on two particular questions, the conditions for deterministic state conversion and measures of the resource. OK, so I'll start with the resource theory of asymmetry. And most of the work I'm going to tell you about is done in collaboration with my former PhD student, Iman Marvian. One of the motivating principles behind this, how to define this resource theory, is something that you may not have heard of, but I'm sure you're familiar with it. So it's called Curie's principle. And the idea is that any asymmetry you see in a physical effect can be traced back and must be found in its causes. So this, I think, most physicists have just sort of internalized this idea. If you do a calculation and you find that the solution breaks some symmetry, you immediately think to yourself, all right, well, why is that symmetry broken? Oh, it's because of the initial conditions or the potential or whatever. And if you find that there was no asymmetry in the statement of the problem, then you think, oh, I've probably made an error somewhere in my calculation. So Curie used this in the context of crystallography. And it seems to me that the intuitions that motivate this principle also motivate a stronger version, which I'll just call the quantitative version of Curie's principle, which is that the measure of asymmetry in some physical phenomena should be no greater than the measure of asymmetry in the cause of that phenomena. So it's just trying to quantify Curie's intuition. So the resource theory I'm going to tell you about is effectively achieving a quantitative version of Curie's principle.
Just to make sure I understand you. If I have a decay of an atom that's in an S-wave state to another S-wave state, but the actualization of it is not symmetric. So because I have, say, two photons coming out and they pick a direction.
Yeah.
So obviously that must be consistent with what you're saying, but in what way is it consistent?
So this is connected, I think, to, well, you're thinking of like a quantum measurement that then breaks the symmetry. Is that the idea? Like, let's say I have like a cloud chamber and I have measurements all around. Well, there's one sense in which the symmetry is respected, which is that if I look at the statistics and I say, what's the relative probability of finding it anywhere, that's uniform.
In a global state, it's respected. But I mean, a physical effect for Curie must have meant observing a photon somewhere, no? I mean, like if you told him that you could get asymmetric photon detection out of a perfectly symmetrical starting point, would he have said that contradicts his principle, so he retracts it?
No, he would have said quantum mechanics is incomplete and requires further.
Yeah, you could go that route. You could say there's a hidden variable that breaks the symmetry. You could take a many worlds route and say, oh, in a particular world you're breaking the symmetry, but in the, the many worlds you're not. I'm not sure exactly what the right response for,
you is if you set us this principle.
Yes.
Do you agree with the conclusion that quantum mechanics is incomplete?
I do believe that, but it's sort of unrelated to my belief in this principle. I'm going to be using this in sort of a less controversial context. I mean, there's also issues with spontaneously broken symmetry. Doesn't that violate Curie's principle? And so for that case, I would have said, well, if I take a classical version of that, I have a column and I add pressure to it, and suddenly it breaks and it picks some direction to break in. That looks like spontaneously broken symmetry and a violation of this principle. But the classical explanation would be, well, there was some defect at the atomic scale, and that's what picked the direction. And I have to make sure that my measures of asymmetry say, look, the measure of asymmetry of that single atom defect is greater than the measure of asymmetry of the final collapsed column. And ultimately, it is going to come out that way because the measure of asymmetry is going to be a measure of information, and the atom serves to pick out a direction just as well as the whole column does. Other questions?
But I think you are saying it's incompatible with our modern understanding of spontaneously broken too, which doesn't rely on any defect.
Yeah, and I think the problem is in the quantum context, the answers to these sorts of questions start to depend sensitively on which interpretation of quantum mechanics you favor. And so I sort of want to avoid that kind of morass of issues and just stick to cases where we can, you know, say uncontroversial things about the symmetries. In any case, what I'm going to be proving to you is, you know, are things that just follow from the formalism of quantum mechanics, so these issues won't arise. Okay, so the first thing to do to define a resource theory is you have to specify which operations are freely available in an unlimited supply. And so in this case, it's going to be the symmetric operations. And then everything else are going to be the asymmetric operations, the asymmetric states. So this resource theory starts by picking a symmetry group. So you have to pick a symmetry group that you're interested in and a unitary representation of that group on every possible system. So for example, if you want to study the resource of rotational asymmetry, then the group of interest is SO3, the group of rotations. And then for every system, like a spin half system has a particular unitary representation of SO3, integer spin systems will have a different representation, and so on. And then you define a subset of all the quantum operations as the symmetric ones. So the most general quantum operations are described by completely positive trace preserving linear maps on the operator space. So they take density operators to density operators. And the symmetric ones are just those that commute with the action of the group. So if E is my map, then if I apply the group transformation and then E, I get the same result as if I do it in the opposite order. That's the definition. So you know, in a circuit diagram, this is what a symmetric operation looks like. And so an example would be if I have a single spin half particle and I consider the map that, you know, its state space is the Bloch sphere. Consider the map that partially depolarizes it. Well, that's, you know, just intuitively rotationally invariant. And, you know, sure enough, if you ask, is it the case that a rotation commutes with this partial depolarization, it does. Okay, now it turns out that's just a mathematical definition, but for every such operation, it is possible to implement it physically in the following way. So if I have a system and I have an operation and I want to apply it, I just take that system and there's some state unitary and trace operation which will allow me to implement this in the following way. I take the system, I couple it to an ancilla, which has been prepared in some symmetric state. I couple them by a unitary, which has the symmetry, so it commutes with the group action. And then finally, I trace over the ancilla, I discard it. There's just one subtlety here, which is that some of these, I'm going to sometimes consider maps that have output spaces that are different from their input spaces. And that just means that I can factorize the composite of system and ancilla. You know, each of those could themselves be highly composite objects. So I can refactorize the final state of all those systems in a different way, and just define, you know, an ancilla or a subset of the final system called A prime, trace over that, and that makes the output Hilbert space different. So I have a notion now of a symmetric operation for any dimension of input and output. So that means I have a notion for states, for measurements, whatever you like. So, you know, in my case of the partially depolarizing operation, one way to implement it would take your spin half particle, interact it via a rotationally invariant Heisenberg interaction with a bath of spins, which are unpolarized, and then ignore the bath, and the overall effect on this spin will be to add noise to it in a rotationally symmetric sort of way. Okay, so now we ask, you know, the basic question of any resource theory. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions on rho and sigma such that I can take rho to sigma by some symmetric operation? So let me be clear, this notation here does not mean, you know, in the rotational context, is there a rotation that takes rho to sigma? No, it means, is there some completely positive map which commutes with all rotations that takes rho to sigma? Okay, so effectively this question is, what are the constraints on state transitions that arise from your dynamics having some symmetry? And when I phrase the question that way, you should immediately think, oh, doesn't Noether's theorem answer that question? So let's review Noether's theorem. So here I'm not going to be talking about symmetries of a Lagrangian or anything like that. I'm just, so the idea that a symmetry of the dynamics implies a conservation law goes all the way back to the work of Lagrange. And these days, we just sort of tend to describe any result of that flavor as Noether's theorem. So I'm sort of using Noether's theorem in that sense, symmetries implying conservation laws. So for my purposes, I'm just interested in a situation where you have a reversible quantum dynamics described by some unitary V, and it has some symmetry. So suppose that the symmetry has a generator L. So L is some Hermitian operator that generates the symmetry group. So if it's a rotation, then L is just an angular momentum operator along the axis of rotation. If it's a time translation, L is the Hamiltonian, et cetera. And so if my V, my unitary, has the symmetry, then of course it has to commute with the generator of that symmetry. And that immediately implies that if the density operator rho evolves to sigma under V, so V rho V dagger is equal to sigma, then the expectation value of the generator L is fixed, and every power of L is also fixed under that evolution. So these are the conservation laws that Noether's theorem implies in this context. And so you know the familiar story about which symmetries imply which conservation laws. And what I want to emphasize is that from this resource theory perspective, there are two deficiencies of Noether's theorem. The first is that it says absolutely nothing about the consequences of symmetries for open system dynamics. So here we assumed that the dynamics was reversible, it was an isolated system. But as I showed you in the past slide, it's perfectly sensible to ask about dynamics that are open but yet have the symmetry property. And so the question is, in those sorts of dynamics, what are the consequences of symmetry? And the second deficiency is that it turns out you can show that even for closed system dynamics, unitary dynamics, Noether's theorem actually doesn't capture all the consequences of symmetry. So you can find pairs of mixed states, rho and sigma, such that by virtue of the operations having the symmetry, you can't go from rho to sigma. And yet, the value of the Noether quantities for the two states are exactly the same. So they don't violate Noether's theorem. So you can't look to those conservation laws to see whether the transformation is possible or not. So in this talk, I'm just going to focus on the first deficiency and how we can fix it. OK, so to do that, I'm going to use another tool of resource theories, which is just to try to find some measures of the resource. So in any resource theory, you can define a measure of the resource in a very simple way. It's just any function from states to the reals, which is non-increasing under the free operations that are allowed in that resource theory. So remember, any state is a resource if you can't prepare it for free. But if I can do some free processing that'll take me from this state to this state, then at best it's done nothing, at worst it's degraded the state. So the measure of the resource should be less over here. So in the context of asymmetry, a measure of asymmetry is a function from states to reals, such that if rho goes to sigma by a symmetric operation, then the measure of asymmetry of rho has to be greater than or equal to the measure of asymmetry for sigma. All right, so for open system dynamics, this gives constraints. And for closed system dynamics, where there's a symmetric unitary, well, if there's a symmetric unitary that goes from rho to sigma, then the inverse of that unitary, which is also symmetric, takes sigma back to rho. So then I have these inequalities going both ways, and the measure of asymmetry should be conserved. So for closed system dynamics, every measure of asymmetry you define immediately gives you a conservation law. All right, so the reason these constraints are useful is sort of the generic reason that in a lot of situations, you might have very complicated equations of motion that you may not be able to solve exactly, or you might have parameters in your equations of motion that you don't know precisely. And the only handle you really have is the symmetries of the dynamics. And so that context, you might want to know, is it possible to get from this initial state rho to this final state sigma? I can't solve the problem exactly. So if I find a single measure of asymmetry that says the asymmetry of sigma is greater than the asymmetry of rho, you immediately know that transition can happen by virtue of the symmetries in the problem. All right, so the natural question to ask is, are the Noether conserved quantities measures of asymmetry? Because they certainly sort of feel like they ought to be, because they satisfy a conservation law in the context of closed system dynamics. So it turns out that they're not. And it's not too hard to see the reason why. So suppose you have some symmetry that's generated by some operator L. Now consider the following two states. So rho is going to be diagonal with respect to the eigenstates of L. And sigma is going to be a coherent superposition of those eigenstates. So it's going to have coherence between them, which means it has off-diagonal elements relative to that basis. So now if I ask how do rho and sigma transform under this group action, rho is going to be completely invariant, so it has the symmetry. Sigma does not, so it's an asymmetric state. It's a resource. And yet, if you look at the expectation values of the Noether quantities, they depend only on the relative weights of the diagonals of these two states, and so they can't tell the difference between them. So you would want a measure of asymmetry to see this difference, and yet none of the Noether quantities can do it. So, yes?
Because I think you said that the measure of asymmetry just has to be like A of rho is greater than or equal to A of sigma, but it seems like they're equal. Am I missing?
Well, I guess I could have just said, are the Noether conserved quantities a non-trivial measure of asymmetry?
Oh, okay. They can be trivial.
Like if it just tells you no information, then strictly speaking, it satisfies that definition, but it's of no use to you. So you can actually prove that anything that's just a function of Noether quantities is a trivial measure. So what it means is that what we want in a measure of asymmetry is something that detects the coherence between the eigenspaces of the generator of that symmetry. And so what we're really looking for are measures of quantum coherence. So we might want to know, for example, not what the variance of the operator L is, but how much of that variance is actually coherent. That's what we need. So now here's the place in the talk where information theory comes to the rescue, right? So we want to be able to find a prescription for coming up with useful measures of asymmetry. And I'm going to show you how to do that using ideas from information theory. So it all relies on this very simple lemma, which makes a bridge between problems in my resource theory and problems in information theory. It's very easy to prove. This is what it says. It says the following two examples of state conversion problems are equivalent. You know, if one is possible, then the other is possible, and vice versa. So the first state conversion problem is the one we've been talking about. Can rho go to sigma by some symmetric operation? And the second state conversion problem is, can the group orbit of rho be taken to the group orbit of sigma by any operation whatsoever? So no constraint of symmetry this time. So what I mean by this is the group orbit of rho is just the set of states that I get by applying every element of the group to rho. And I want to go to the corresponding element in the group orbit of sigma. But I can do it with any operation. So it's not so implausible that these might be equivalent, because over here, that your job is sort of easier. You only have a single state going to a single state. Whereas here, you have to take every element of a set of states to a corresponding element of another set. That's a harder problem. But over here, you have a constraint on what operations you're allowed to use, whereas here you don't. So that sort of balances it out. So you can prove this really easily from the definition of a symmetric operation, but I want to give you sort of a feel for why it's true. So I'm going to give you the physicist proof of how this works. And it basically boils down to the fact that there's a problem which, described from two different reference vantages, correspond to these two different descriptions of the problem. So the first case is basically Alice is preparing a system in a state rho. She's going to send it over to Bob. Bob's going to do some operation on it, and he's going to send it back to sigma. And the task is that at the end of the day, it should be described as state sigma relative to Alice's frame. So Alice describes the initial state as rho, the final state as sigma. And when you ask, well, how does Alice describe the operations that Bob does? Well, we assume here that Alice and Bob have Cartesian reference frames that are not aligned. Okay, so they don't know what the relative orientation of these two frames are. We're talking about rotational symmetry in this example. And so whatever operation Bob does relative to his frame, Alice describes it relative to her frame as some rotation of the operation relative to his frame. But she doesn't know what that rotation is. So she has to average over all possibilities. And that leaves the overall effect of that operation relative to her frame as a rotationally invariant operation. So from Alice's perspective, it's the left-hand problem. Can rho go to sigma by some rotationally symmetric operation? But if you look from Bob's perspective, he says, all right, well, what's the initial state? He knows that it was rho relative to Alice's frame. And he knows that there's some rotation that connects their frames. So it's some rotation of rho. But he doesn't know which one. So he says, oh, it's one element of this orbit of rho. And I just don't know which it is. And my task is to take it to the corresponding element of the orbit of sigma. But now if you ask, well, what kinds of operations he can do? Well, these are relative to his frame. So there's no restriction at all. He can do any quantum operation he likes. And so I have the right-hand version of the problem. So the reason this is, you can think of this as an information theoretic version of the problem, is that whenever you have a set of quantum states, you can think of them as encoding a classical variable. So in this case, the orbit of rho under the group can be thought of as a quantum encoding of a classical variable that ranges over the group. So you can think of this set of states as just a way of, you know, somebody sending, like Alice might send information about a group element to Bob by preparing different quantum states for every possible element of the group that she might want to communicate. And so the question here is just, can this encoding of the group element be transformed to this encoding by any processing? And that's another way of saying, does the first encoding contain more information about the group than the second encoding does? If the second encoding contained more information, then clearly there would be no processing that could take me from the first to the second. Because, you know, if you've sent me some states, they have a certain amount of indistinguishability, no amount of processing is going to make them more distinguishable. I already have all the data that I'm ever going to get about that. And so processing is only going to decrease the amount of information. So this is the information theoretic version of the problem. So now that I've explained that all to you, it should be clear that to define a measure of asymmetry for a state rho relative to some group G, it suffices to find a measure of the information encoded in the orbit of rho about the group G. But now we're in a nice position because quantum information theorists have come up with many measures of the information that some quantum encoding has about a classical variable. And so we can just take any one of those and put it through the conversion and get a measure of asymmetry out. Okay, so I won't take you through the details of that. Let me just give you sort of a sampler of the kinds of measures of asymmetry you can get in this way. So if you start with a particular measure of information called the Holevo quantity, and you put it through that lemma, you get something that we call the Holevo asymmetry. And it has this form. So S here is the von Neumann entropy. This calligraphic G is an averaging over the group transformations with some particular weighting. So you get a measure for every choice of weighting over the group. And so what this says is that if I take my state rho, if it's not invariant under the group action, then when I average over the group action, it's going to become more mixed. And therefore, the difference in its final entropy from its initial entropy is a measure of how asymmetric it was. Here's another example. So this is just the one norm of the commutator. So remember I said that for a state rho to be asymmetric, it has to have coherence between the eigenspaces of the generator L of that asymmetry. And so you would expect that any failure of commutativity might be a measure of that coherence. And sure enough, if you take the one norm, you can prove that this is indeed a measure of asymmetry. And then this example here is a bit peculiar. You start on the information theoretic side with the order S relative Renyi entropy, and you derive this quantity, which looks a little bit like the variance over L, except that here we have rho to the power S and rho to the power 1 minus S. So this guy has the nice feature that if I put in a pure state here, it reduces to the variance over L. So it sort of just says, oh, the coherent spread in L is the variance. But if I put in a symmetric state, well, then that commutes with L, and this goes to 0. So both this quantity and this quantity have that feature that they just measure the sort of coherent spread in the between the eigenspaces of L.
Was there some nice meaning to the limit as S goes to 1 or if that even exists?
Yes. So as S goes to 1, I'm not sure. I think that's the case where you might recover the, I can't remember. But yeah, there is. Yeah. Yes.
In the Holevo symmetry, what's the role of P of G?
Well, it's just I'm really just describing a family of measures here. So for any P of G you choose, this will be a measure of asymmetry. So an obvious example would be the Haar measure over the group. But you can also if I'm talking about rotations, I can instead take the measure that's just uniform over the rotations about one axis. That's it. That's not uniform over all elements of SO3. And that gives me a different measure of asymmetry. It's more sort of asymmetry relative to rotations about that axis. But given that it's a subgroup of SO3, it's also a kind of SO3 asymmetry. So asymmetry relative to some U1 subgroup of SO3 is also asymmetry relative to SO3. So there are many applications of these things. I just wanted to show you a couple of them so that you know that what you can use these things for. So the first one is to derive fundamental limits on the performance of amplifiers. So quantum amplifiers always add some noise to a signal. And people are interested in, you know, what the ultimate bounds on that are. What's the least amount of noise you might add? And typically results in this space sort of start with a model of a very particular amplifier in a very particular context. And it depends on details like, you know, am I talking about indeterministic amplification or deterministic amplification? And this sort of approach allows you to just say, it doesn't matter what the amplifier is, as long as it has the symmetry property. So if we're, you know, in quantum optics and you tell me I have a phase insensitive amplifier, I can immediately start deriving bounds. So for example, if I just use the Halevo asymmetry that I defined, then if rho goes to sigma by symmetric operations, I get this inequality. I rearrange terms, and I get, on the left-hand side, the increase in the entropy. So this is the entropy of the final state minus the entropy of the initial state. And on the right-hand side, I get a lower bound on that increase in entropy. So just to give you one example, suppose P here is the uniform measure of the group. And suppose I'm trying to amplify angular momentum. So I start with a spin a half particle, and I'm trying to amplify it to spin J. So I can do that, no problem. But the entropy of the randomized spin a half particle is 1, and the entropy of a spin J particle averaged over all rotations is about log J. And so the right-hand side here is on the order of log J. And so the more I want to amplify, the more noise I have to put into the system. And the basic reason for this is that the information conservation principle holds here, that the amount of information that this system contains about direction cannot be more than this one. So it could not be pure spin J coming out of a pure spin half, because that would have more information about direction just coming out for free. And that's why we have to have noise added. Another nice example is quantum metrology. So metrology is the study of high precision measurements. So it's used for things like you know, detecting forces, building accelerometers, you know, detecting weak fields, or, you know, I guess gravitational detectors are an example of that. Quantum metrology is just using quantum techniques to try to get particularly high precision. And so one example would be, you know, suppose you have a magnetic field pointing in some known direction. You want to measure its strength. So you send some rotationally asymmetric system through that field, and you want to measure how much it's rotated to figure out what the strength of the field is. So obviously, if you ask what are the properties of the state of that system that are relevant for this task, the answer is it should be as rotationally asymmetric as possible. If it's rotationally symmetric, it's useless. If it has more rotational asymmetry, it'll better measure that weak field. And so if you think about this information theoretic notion of asymmetry, it makes perfect sense. I want it to be the case that the different elements of the orbit of this state are as distinguishable as possible. That will help me estimate how much it's been rotated by. And therefore, I want the measure of information that this state contains about the rotational group to be as high as possible, which is just saying I want its measure of asymmetry to be as high as possible. If you look at sort of a standard figure of merit that people use to assess metrology schemes, it's the variance in an unbiased estimator for the phase shift that's occurred or the rotation that's occurred. And you can prove that there's something called the quantum Kramer-Rao bound. And you can prove that actually this upper bound here involves a measure of asymmetry. It's exactly that third one I showed you on the slide, which is called the skew information and was previously studied by Wigner and Yanasi and Dyson, although its role as a measure of asymmetry was not previously recognized. So anyways, these sorts of tools can help you make progress on the problem of, for instance, coming up with practical schemes wherein, you know, you have noise and states aren't pure for finding the best schemes for doing metrology. Oh, I did. Yeah, well, it just so happens that you know, the bound that people have derived is for the case of S is equal to half. So roughly speaking, you know, these different measures can have different operational significance. So, you know, if I'm looking at a particular figure of merit, you know, so if instead of wanting to, you know, minimize the mean square error in my metrology task, I want to look at the worst case error, for instance, then it'll be some different measure of asymmetry that will quantify the success of my scheme.
Is there a way to estimate the discriminant of these measures? Like, I'm looking for the one that distinguishes between more rows and sigmas, and even my symmetries, for example.
So it turns out that this is, you know, part of the beauty of the resource theory perspective is that when you look at this question of, you know, what's the structure of deterministic conversions among states, you find that it's not a total order. It's always a quasi-order. And because it's a quasi-order, there are pairs of states such that there is no symmetric operation that'll take me from this one to this one, or vice versa. And so I know that there's no single measure that can capture that quasi-order, you know, because every single measure just defines a total order of those states. So I'm going to need multiple measures to really do justice to the full structure of that set of states. And so in this context, it really teaches you to resist the temptation of saying, oh, there's sort of one measure to rule them all, and I have to find it. It's my job to find the super measure. No, you know, there's just different measures, and they're appropriate for different figures of merit for given operational tasks, and none of them really trump any of the others. It's, in some sense, it's just a collection of them. If you find a complete set which allow you to figure out what the quasi-order is, then that's sort of the best you can do. Okay, so let me then go back to Noether's theorem. So here's a partially rehabilitated version of Noether's theorem that actually applies to symmetric open system dynamics. So it just, you know, write down all of the asymmetry measures that you find, and those all form necessary conditions for the possibility of a state conversion from rho to sigma. But you know, even if I want a sufficient condition, so some conditions which will assure me that rho can go to sigma by symmetric operations, then I know that, you know, the infinite list of all the asymmetry measures will do, but you know, that's not very practical. I'd prefer to have some finite set of conditions I can test to see whether this transition is possible. And unfortunately, for the general case, that's still an open problem. So we haven't solved that yet. However, we have solved it for the case of pure states. So if rho and sigma are both pure, we know what the conditions are such that rho can go to sigma, and that's in this paper here. And just another plug for information theory, the way that proof works is by noticing that when you convert the problem over to the information theoretic side, it's something for which the solution is known. Or, you know, you can leverage some known results pretty easily to get the solution. Okay, so I want to be a bit more brief in talking about the resource theory. Oh.
So the operation, they're supposed to be a linear operations, or it could be any operation?
So these operations have to be valid quantum operations, so completely positive, trace preserving, and linear.
They have to be linear. Okay.
Yeah. Yes?
Did you also try to apply these measures on the previous work on reference frame degradation and injective reference frames?
So that work is quite old now, but you know, we in that work we looked at a particular measure of asymmetry. You know, ideally, what you'd like to do, if you really found sort of a set of conditions for this transition to be possible, you would have a sort of you would know, you know, what reduction of the quantum state. So not all the information in the quantum state is relevant to its asymmetry properties, but you might find out here are the parts of the quantum state that are relevant to asymmetry. And you might have a description of that, so you might have a complete set of asymmetry measures, and then you would just need to, you know, characterize how each of those was degraded, and then you'd have a sort of full characterization of the effect of having used this quantum state to do a measurement or a transformation. It's degraded in some way. Maybe in this vein, I'll mention that you can also use this bridge with information theory to realize that there must be degradation of the frame, because over on the information theoretic side, there's a principle that says if I'm trying to gain information about a state which is drawn from some set of non-orthogonal states, then I must disturb it. When I convert that fact back over to the asymmetry side, it just says if I'm using some quantum state whose orbit under the group is a set of non-orthogonal states, then necessarily I'm going to disturb it. So essentially, there's sort of an interplay. Any result on information gain disturbance in quantum information theory becomes a result on degradation of reference frames. Yes?
A little bit of a handle on you came up with this particular example of the idea of resourcefulness in these symmetric operations. So the definition of resourcefulness seems to be that you say a state is resourceful if it can't just simply be produced using these restricted operations, and then the resource is resourceful because it allows you to circumvent these operations or this restriction of operations. Now, this is a little bit circular, so I'm trying to kind of break the circle by saying when you have some particular task in mind, like the one you had on, I think, a couple of slides ago, how do you know that a given resource state is actually useful for accomplishing that task? Is do you just need to know that it's resourceful, or do you need to have more than just the fact that it's resourceful?
Well, maybe the more fundamental definition is you can't prepare that state under the free operations. That makes it a resource.
Yeah.
Then for any given task, say, you know, I want to rotate something about some axis. Well, that's an asymmetric operation.
Right.
Can this given state be used to do that operation?
Yeah.
So that's an example of that last question on the slide, that can I convert the resource of a state into the resource of a non-free operation?
Right.
And there are, you know, I've written long papers about this. It's not an easy issue. So there's, you can decompose the operation and the state into sort of different modes of asymmetries, sort of like a harmonic decomposition. And so one thing you can say is that the state has to have at least those modes that are present in the operation if it's going to simulate it.
Yeah, so the idea is somehow that it's not just simply enough to say that it's a resource, is that it has to be somehow the right kind of resource. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks, yeah.
Okay, so the resource theory of athermality. So the principles that motivate me here are, mostly I'm going to talk about the second law of thermodynamics. So let me remind you of its sort of original formulation by Carnot and Kelvin. There's no thermodynamic process whose sole effect is to transform heat extracted from a source at uniform temperature completely into work. Later, we found entropic forms of the second law. And unfortunately here, the textbooks really differ. There's lots of different beliefs about, you know, what the right way of stating the entropic form of the second law is. Here I've sort of distilled a sort of uncontroversial core out of all those sorts of approaches, and it's this one. All physical systems in thermal equilibrium can be characterized by a quantity called entropy, which cannot decrease in any process in which the system remains adiabatically isolated, i.e. shielded from heat exchange with its environment. So this leaves a lot of questions. So, you know, what about systems that are not in thermal equilibrium? Do they satisfy the entropic second law? What about systems that are not adiabatically isolated? What about systems that are microscopic? Does this result only hold in the thermodynamic limit, or can I also apply it to individual systems? What about the quantum case? Does anything new come in? Do I just have to upgrade the entropy to von Neumann entropy, or is there something else going on? And then finally, is this non-decrease of entropy criterion a sufficient condition for inferring that some particular thermodynamic process is possible, or is it only a necessary condition? So I'm going to answer all of these questions using the resource theory of athermality. So again, starting point, figure out what are the free operations in this resource theory. And so the idea here is we want to allow as many operations as we can while not making the capability to do work in unlimited amounts. So you want to give the agent as much as possible without giving the ability to do arbitrary work. So you ask, well, what must they have in that case? So first of all, you realize that the only unitaries you can allow them are the energy-conserving unitaries. Because if you give yourself a unitary that does not conserve energy, then I could always take a two-level system from its ground state to its excited state, and that would be doing work. So clearly, I can only have energy-conserving unitaries. I can also then prepare any state in its thermal state at some fixed temperature. So this is the quantum thermal state for any system. It's just the Gibbs form, where in the exponent, I have the Hamiltonian for that system over kt, where t is the temperature, and this is the partition function. And so here you see that, you know, just as in the asymmetry theory, I had to pick a group, here I have to pick a temperature. So a resource theory is defined for a particular temperature. Well, what's the right temperature to use? It depends on your context. If, you know, you're working at room temperature, then the thermal states that you have readily available and unlimited supply for free are things at room temperature. And anything that's not at room temperature is a resource from which you can, you know, you can couple to your room temperature bath and draw some work from. But if I'm in interstellar space, then it's 3 degrees Kelvin, and anything deviating from 3 degrees Kelvin is a resource from which I can extract work. So it depends on your context. Another thing to notice is that, you know, because the free stuff comes in unlimited supply, I can take an unlimited number of these guys, which is ultimately like saying you have a heat bath at temperature T. And so it's basically like that original formulation of the second law. We're allowing you to have a single heat bath, not two heat baths, because two heat baths would be enough to do arbitrary work, but a single heat bath at a fixed temperature. Now, what's interesting is that you might have thought that there would be lots of alternatives for what states you allow for free, together with these energy-conserving unitaries. But you can actually show that once you've fixed this, a family of states, which is thermal at a given temperature, is the only set of states you can allow while not allowing arbitrary amounts of work to be done. So if I give you some other state that isn't thermal, and I say you can have it in an unlimited supply, it basically means that the resource theory collapses into you can do any quantum operation, anything you like. So you don't get anything non-trivial. So in fact, sort of thermal states are picked out as sort of being the only ones that define a non-trivial resource theory. OK, and then finally, you allow that you can do a trace over any system. So that's just ignoring something. And that's it. Those are the free operations. So what it means is that if I want to combine these components into a sort of a general completely positive map, I can do the following. I can take my system, couple it to thermal state by an energy conserving unitary, and discard an ancilla. And that will give me a general thermal operation. OK, so what are the conditions under which rho can go to sigma by thermal operations? Let's look at some measures of athermality. Those will immediately give us some necessary conditions. So a measure of athermality is just a function which is non-increasing under the thermal operations. Same sort of deal as we had last time. And again, we have this nice bridge to information theory. Information theory comes to the rescue once again. And so now we show the equivalence of two state conversions problems again. So over on the left, we have the one we're interested in, a state rho on system S being converted to a state sigma on S prime by thermal operations. And on the right, I have a set of states, rho, and the thermal state for that same system being converted by any operation to this pair of states, sigma on its on system S prime and the thermal state for that system. The star here just means that, in fact, I only have proven this backward arrow in the case of quasi-classical states, but I think it's true generally. In any case, it's only the forward arrow that's going to measure for defining measures of athermality. So that uncertainty is not going to affect us. OK, so the proof of the forward arrow is totally trivial. It just comes from the fact that, you know, here's the general form of a thermal operation I just showed you. If you plug in as the initial state a thermal state, then you have a thermal state on S tensor, thermal state on A. That's a thermal state on S tensor A. And if I do an energy conserving unitary, it stays thermal. And then if I do a trace over some system, it stays thermal. So I get a thermal state coming out. So any thermal operation will preserve the thermal state. And that's why if there exists a thermal operation that takes rho to sigma, then there also exists some operation that both takes rho to sigma and takes the thermal state to the thermal state. It's just whatever that thermal operation was. So I have this arrow. OK, so again, you know, I can now define measures of athermality, deviations from the thermal state, just using any measure of the statistical distinguishability of two quantum states. So I can think of that pair of quantum state as encoding information about a classical bit. And all that's really important here is that this pair of states should encode more information about that classical bit than this pair of states should. So any measure of the distinguishability of two quantum states will give me a measure of athermality. And so in particular, you know, I'll find, for instance, that you know, if I look at this resource state, rho, and this thermal state, so these circles just represent the probability for these different energy levels, so this is the Gibbs distribution, there's some statistical distinguishability of these two distributions. So this rho is a resource. I can extract some work from it. It's not thermal. But so is this. So if I have a system whose energy just has two energy levels and they're degenerate, then the thermal state is just a uniform distribution over those two. And anything that's not a uniform distribution, like a pure state in one of those two levels, is not thermal, is an athermal resource. And so immediately you see that you know, I've chosen these probability distributions so that this pair of probability distributions is just as statistically distinguishable as this pair. And therefore, these resources are equivalent. And this essentially makes sense of that whole business of Maxwell's daemon and Landauer erasure and so forth. So if I have a daemon who has a memory, and every bit in his memory is initialized to some particular state, then the daemon can use that memory as fuel to you know, increase the temperature difference. But at the end of the day, that fuel will be used up, and then it'll have to stop. So purity is a resource just as much as non-thermality is. But it's a kind of non-thermality. So anyhow, you play all the same tricks. You take your favorite measures of statistical distinguishability. You derive measures of athermality from them. So a nice one is the difference in the free energy of your resource state rho from the free energy of the thermal state for the same system. Here's another one, which is called the max free energy. It turns out these have operational interpretations. So this guy will tell you how much work you can extract if you have arbitrary many copies of this sort of state. This one will tell you the work it costs to make just a single copy. That tends to be more than if you're making arbitrarily many copies. And so again, we have the rehabilitated form of the second law of thermodynamics, which is that a necessary condition on the possibility of this transition is that any measure of athermality should be non-increasing. And this holds for systems that are quantum. I said nothing about these states being in equilibrium. They can be out of equilibrium. They don't have to be adiabatically isolated because they can exchange heat with the heat bath. And they can be totally microscopic. There's no thermodynamic limit here. If you specialize to the case of systems that are adiabatically isolated, you recover the standard notion that that this free energy here reduces to just the negative entropy. So in this case, entropy should be non-decreasing. But you get all these other constraints in addition to that one. It's not the only constraint in that case. And furthermore, it holds, you know, with these other assumptions relaxed. But of course, if you wanted a fully rehabilitated form of the second law, what you'd really want is not, you know, a list of an infinite number of athermality measures, but rather some finite set of conditions you can verify to assert that rho can be taken to sigma. And unfortunately, that's still an open problem. So far, we only know the solution for the case of states that commute with the Hamiltonian, which is first found in this paper. And one more plug for information theory. Turns out it was a lot of hard work finding this solution. But if you use this bridge to information theory, you can just pull the solution to the information theoretic problem out of some obscure literature and bring it over into the athermality context and have a much simpler solution to this problem. OK, so let me wrap up. So I've tried to convince you that the asymmetry of a state can be understood as its capacity to encode information about the symmetry group. And the athermality of a state, its deviation from thermal equilibrium, can also be understood as the statistical distinguishability of that state from the thermal state for the same type of system. And therefore, both the property of asymmetry and the property of athermality are reduced to essentially information theoretic notions. And then finally, I've tried to convince you that the rehabilitated form of Noether's theorem that applies to open system dynamics and the rehabilitated second law of thermodynamics, both can be understood as constraints that follow from a very deep and simple information theoretic principle, which is that if I receive a signal from somebody and the different states have a certain amount of distinguishability, I can't increase that distinguishability by data processing. So there's never any increase of information under data processing. That's sometimes called the data processing inequality. So both Noether's theorem and the second law of thermodynamics seem to be ultimately just equivalent statements to that principle of information theory, the data processing inequality. All right, so we all know that entanglement theory, which is sort of the first and best known resource theory, has had huge applications. So first of all, in quantum information, it appears all over the place, applications in quantum computation, quantum cryptography. But in more recent years, it's sort of further afield than that. So there are applications for the study of phase transitions and condensed matter physics, for density matrix renormalization group, for black hole thermodynamics, for the holographic principle. It's all over the place, which sort of suggests that taking the resource theory perspective can have broad applications across physics if you're studying some interesting property. And I've tried to convince you that the resource theory of asymmetry and athermality, those are both interesting properties that will have applications across a broad range of fields of physics. And so in particular, the things that I would like to think some more about in the context of this resource theory of asymmetry are, this issue of spontaneously broken symmetry that we talked about in the beginning. How can you square that with Curie's principle, that quantitative version of Curie's principle, which I derived? Can measures of asymmetry serve as order parameters to describe phase transitions? I think the answer is yes. I have some evidence in favor of this. It may be, ultimately, that order parameters should be thought of as fundamentally measures of the asymmetry in a system. Are there any lessons for particle statistics from trying to quantify the amount of asymmetry a system has relative to permutations? So that's a different sort of asymmetry, but these tools can be used just as well to apply to that case. And then finally, there's this nice connection that states that are invariant under time reversal have all real amplitudes in them. So the complex field, the role of the complex field in quantum theory can be thought of as an instance of time reversal asymmetry. So again, by quantifying how much time reversal asymmetry I have, I might be able to say something about how much does any given task require the complex field in quantum theory. For the resource theory of athermality, there's sort of a similar set of directions I'd like to work in. So I was talking about thermal equilibrium, but there's also mechanical equilibrium, chemical equilibrium, gravitational equilibrium. So you can do the same game for any of those applications of thermodynamics. There's something called the Jarzynski equality, which relates work to the free energy difference. And I suspect that we can get a stronger form of the Jarzynski equality out of some of the stuff I told you about. Another interesting fact is that this resource theory approach makes it clear that if what you have for free is stuff that's all thermal but at a negative temperature, so it has population inversion, that's a fine resource theory. And so anything which is now not at that negative temperature becomes a resource. And so the question here is, might there be some realistic physical systems wherein, you know, what is free and generic is all at some negative temperature? And then finally, it's conceivable that some of the conceptual problems in relativistic thermodynamics and black hole thermodynamics might be informed by this resource theory approach. So that's basically it. So I hope I've convinced you that you know, there is something to the claim that information theory might be provide principles that are foundational principles on the same sort of stage as symmetry principles and thermodynamic principles. Personally, I believe that, you know, that we're going to see a lot more role of information theory in physics over the next 50 years. And I sort of see it as the duty of our generation of physicists to kind of rethink every topic in physics from an information theoretic perspective. And I think that that will be a fruitful enterprise. So thanks for your attention.
About the normalization.
That's a good question. So you're asking about the resource theory perspective, not the sort of information theoretic perspective. So there's two separate questions. I mean, there are sort of applications of information that sort of have nothing to do with this resource theory context. I don't know the answer to either of those questions. So yeah, it'd be worth looking into. Put it on the list.
Yes. Maybe you could take
course for operations.
It looks like
something
that's good for the yeah.
You made two kinds of claims. You made claims that resource theory in symmetry and thermality can be useful to enlarge our understanding of symmetry and thermality. Maybe, at least from my perspective, there's a case for that. But you also made a stronger argument at times that resource theory for thermality and symmetry should be used to overturn or take over the notion of symmetry. So I want to ask you the obvious naive question, which is the wedge between those two claims. Which is, do you believe that the second law of thermodynamics and Nevis theorem are true in your universe when there's no information processing going on?
We're true in your universe.
Yeah. So I can understand if we're dealing with laboratory science and we can take the perspective that laboratory science can be enfolded into a general framework of information processing because we're interacting with systems as we prepare them and develop them and measure them. But in science, we do more than that. We also, in physics, to talk about things that happened long before there was any agents to the information process.
So I think I get the flavor of your question. And the flavor is, you know, sort of it's common to sort of similar questions I get often that, you know, these resource theories are what I like to call kind of agent-centric theories. They're sort of tools that, you know, an experimentalist or an observer will use to sort of achieve their ends. You know, can I engineer a system that'll take me from here to here? And, you know, a dynamical theory is very different. A dynamical theory takes it as its goal to just say, oh, look, there's some system, it's isolated, and how is it going to evolve? You know, and it doesn't make any reference to human observers or their purposes. And, you know, the business of physics is really to talk about those dynamical theories and, you know, these agent-centric theories. Well, they're kind of like plumbing and engineering, but they're not, you know, really physics. And my response to that is, yes, I think the dynamical theories are more fundamental, but here's a really important point to recall, which is that if I prove that, you know, there's a certain state transition which, given these resources, you cannot engineer to occur, you know, so given thermal resources, you can't take this state to this state. Well, if you can't do it with all your engineering resources, I've given you unlimited supply, you know, I haven't put any bounds on you, then it means nature can't do it either. So any constraint that you obtain from one of these resource theories is also a constraint on, you know, what can happen in nature. Now, the resource theory is not going to answer questions like, you know, if I have this particular Hamiltonian, I just let it go, precisely how is that going to evolve? But it can give you some principles, it can give you some constraints on what's going to happen. And that's how I'm using it here. Now, so to some extent, you know, in the early universe, there were no computers, no information processing, no agents. That doesn't mean that information theory is irrelevant, right? So you can take these two views on information theory. On the one hand, it's like plumbing, it's, you know, engineering, it's just about, you know, doing stuff. On the other hand, you know, the foundations of computer science are connected to the foundations of mathematics and the foundations of physics, and it's a very deep theory in a certain perspective. So I can imagine that, you know, ideas from information theory may very well be highly relevant to the physics in the early universe. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Let me ask that follow-up question.
Okay.
So here's a concrete asymmetry question that probably a lot of people here know about the early universe, which is matter, antimatter, asymmetry.
Yeah.
But in that case, no one knows exactly what the reason for that is, but a lot of ideas that people have considered are not that the fundamental laws are completely symmetric, matter, antimatter, but there are some cases where it's broken.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's a lot of cases where it's not broken, and so that's a case maybe where you have the loud operations sometimes let you break them, but some of them don't. And now the question is there some way you can kind of put this into your framework and say something meaningful about this particular question?
I think so. I'm not sure, but I mean, one thing you can do is you can take any asymmetry that you observe in the universe today and try to quantify it using some of these measures. And then if you believe that the fundamental dynamical laws have the symmetry, you can say, well, whatever measure of asymmetry I see today, the initial state had to have that measure of asymmetry as well, assuming that, you know, the whole universe is isolated, so it's conserved. And so that can kind of constrain hypotheses about what the initial state could possibly have been in a more quantitative way. So it doesn't help you sort of generate, you know, hypotheses about, you know, what could explain that sort of initial condition, but it might help you be more quantitative about what's required of your boundary condition. So it'd be the same for, like, you know, you look at the inhomogeneity in the universe today, so that's asymmetry relative to spatial translations. You know, people say, oh, it's the quantum fluctuations in the early universe that led to that. Here's a way of quantifying what we see today, and that's going to be a constraint on how much asymmetry relative to spatial translations there must have been in the early universe to account for it.
But in certainly in that case, we believe that breaking is spontaneous. So it's very important to understand spontaneous symmetry breaking quantum mechanics, which, as I understand, is still a work in progress.
That's right. Well, if you say, look, all the dynamics is just unitarian or beta the symmetry, then, you know, this has to hold, because that's just a theorem. So if you say, well, actually,
no, there's, you know, quantum mechanics, you know, the right interpretation of quantum mechanics has collapse mechanisms that are fundamental, so the fundamental dynamics is not unitary, and therefore I can, you know, I'll still have symmetry on a statistical basis, right? So, you know, I'll see things equally. But in this single instance, I'll have symmetry breaking. Personally, I don't like dynamical collapse theories that give up on unitarity, so I don't think that's the right sort of solution. I suspect that the right sort of solution is that all the sort of work we make spontaneously, the idea of spontaneously broken symmetry, it's required to do certain work, and I think that work can be done by merely breaking kind of relative symmetries. So it's never, you know, the symmetry of the, you know, the whole universe, you know, relative to nothing on the outside. It's always sort of how things are oriented relative to one another. And those symmetries tend not to be symmetries of the dynamical laws. And so you can break those without running afoul of these sorts of results. I think that's the resolution. But I haven't looked into it carefully.
Implies that what we see of the universe is an open system. Facing that.
Sorry, am I saying that?
Yeah, I'm asking.
No, these tools were meant to deal with situations where you may be describing an open system,
But they can also deal with situations where it's a closed system. So it's just, you know, every measure asymmetry becomes a conservation law in the context of a closed system. So it can deal with those situations as well. But it can, you know, whereas Noether's theorem can only deal with the traditional Noether's theorem can only deal with the closed system case. So I'm not saying this is only applicable for open systems. It's applicable to both. Oh, the spontaneous symmetry breaking. Sorry, I misunderstood your question. Yeah, that's right. That it's, you know, you're really breaking symmetry relative to something else in the background, and the composite system is not breaking the global symmetry. It's only the relational symmetries that are breaking, and those aren't the fundamental symmetries of the dynamical laws. Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay, sure. So if just to follow on from that line of thinking, so you're saying that if you had some kind of state at some point in the far past in the universe that has some amount of asymmetry as quantified by one or more of these measures, you're saying that if you look at the action of the processes that you think happened since then and what they do to those measures, you could kind of work backwards from that to try and decide how much asymmetry there was in the early universe, because you can look at like how much asymmetry there is now. In the past, there had to have been, if all the processes are symmetric, as you say, then there had to have been more asymmetry in the past in some sense. Are you saying that you can kind of work backwards from that and decide how much asymmetry is in the past? Is that the claim you're making at the end of your talk?
If it were an open system dynamics, then all you could do is say, okay, the previous asymmetry was equal to or greater than what we see today. But if you're talking about cosmology and you've got the whole universe and you're confident that it's a closed system dynamics, then you have something stronger you can say, which is that every measure of asymmetry is conserved because that dynamics is unitary and it's reversible. Okay. So if you quantify the asymmetry today, you've quantified the asymmetry that held at all times in the past.
Okay. So these laws, as we're stating, in sort of a global form, right? There was a global generator of symmetry, things like that. Are there local versions of these extra measures of the, these extra conservation laws, something with the curve and the density?
Sorry, can you just repeat the question?
These extra measures of asymmetry, say, were stated in a global way.
Your symmetry group was always a set of global operations.
Yeah, that's right. I was sort of.
So he's wondering what happened with gauged.
No. Just saying, can you? So the usual conservation, we think about conservation law is that, you know, divergence of a current equal to zero. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps the divergence of a current bigger than zero. There is some
entropy production. So.
Can this state, these other measures of asymmetry be recast in that form, or are they purely global?
He wants it in the current, their local currents.
Are the local currents for this inequalities or equality?
So I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I think.
Well, it's equilibrium
charge. Yeah.
It's a divergence of some current being zero, but it can still move around.
Yeah.
So are there any versions of your the conservation symmetries which correspond to local conservation?
But it might be something like an entropy current whose divergence has to be non-negative.
Rather than total
entropy.
Sure. So
rather than total quantities, local quantities.
So I think typically,
if I've understood correctly, typically not. The charge is something I don't typically think about because, you know, the phase conjugate to charge is something that we typically can't prepare coherent superpositions of different charge states. So, you know, everything is sort of symmetric from my perspective. In practice, but you know, in the context of quantum optics, where I'm sort of happier to think,
any symmetry you want, will be local.
Angular momentum density. You can make local.
Every symmetry.
So any
conservation law I've used to see
is
local.
There's a difference between another conservation laws, which I think
can be violated locally, and the kinds of conservation laws I'm proposing here, which are of measures of asymmetry. So remember, I said that those Noether quantities were not measures of asymmetry.
Local constant. So if there is an asymmetric current, how much is changing in a space, is there an influx?
Yeah, so I think
you can certainly, you know, define, say, like the reduced density operator in a local region, that's the quantum state, what's the asymmetry there? So you can certainly do that. although you want to be careful because, you know, it could be that the correlations in your quantum state are important for the amount of asymmetry. So by just looking at the kind of local states and quantifying their asymmetry, you sort of may miss part of the picture by virtue of the correlations. Sorry, and what is it?
Yeah, no, that's not the case. So I don't lose anything by having the local density and the flux from the boundary. So I'm trying to understand how the conservation laws you're discussing differ from the standard ones. Mm-hmm. So I particularly would like to understand if they differ by the fact that this principle does not hold, for example.
Well, so I think there's some interesting questions there. So, you know, what's the precise relation between the Noether quantities and these measures of asymmetry? So if, you know, if I write down a complete set of measures of asymmetry that are complete in the sense that they provide sufficient conditions for the possibility of a state transition, then I get, you know, a new set of conservation laws. And so what you can prove actually is that if you're talking about state transitions among pure states with reversible operations, a complete set of measures of asymmetry, those conservation laws, are equivalent to the conservation of the Noether quantities. So the one case where the Noether conservation laws are necessary and sufficient is when you have pure states undergoing unitary dynamics, so necessary and sufficient for the possibility of the transition. But they're not themselves measures of asymmetry, even though they're conserved. So roughly speaking, you know, because they can be written as functions of measures of asymmetry, therefore they're conserved. I think that in some ways there's when we think of the conservation of the usual Noether quantities, often, like, you know, I read textbooks that try to give an intuitive explanation of Noether's theorem. They often make the following mistake. They essentially appeal to Curie's principle, and they say, oh, well, you know, if you could go from something that was rotationally symmetric to something that broke rotational symmetry, well, you know, that would be a violation. They don't say it, but that would be a violation of Curie's principle. And Noether's theorem is basically saying that. Well, that's not true, because Noether's theorem is saying more, that if I have something that's rotating and breaking the symmetry, it can't suddenly, you know, rotate at a higher angular momentum. That would violate Noether's theorem. So you might say, oh, so the intuition that underlies Noether's theorem must be the quantitative Curie principle that says, oh, the amount of asymmetry can't change. But that's not right either, because I proved that all those Noether quantities are not themselves measures of asymmetry. So intuitions about, you know, whether measures of asymmetry should be conserved locally might well be very different from whether the Noether quantities are conserved locally. So it could very well be that, you know, measures of asymmetry, you know, the correlations are important, even though they're not for the Noether quantities. Yeah.
Not change them from Betelgeuse without passing to the walls of my lab, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. So in that sense, you couldn't...
Is that something I should be worried about? Or...
Yeah,
it's a good question. I haven't thought about that specific question, but I would expect that you would find, just because it's quantum mechanics, I haven't done anything funny here, I don't think you'd be able to change the measure of asymmetry over there by doing operations here. Although, because it's information theoretic, maybe by learning something over here, you know, like if I learn that more about the system over there by doing an operation here, then I might at the end of the day say, oh, now I know what direction it's pointing in. Therefore, its measure of asymmetry has increased because the measure of asymmetry is ultimately a measure of my information about how it's pointing. So perhaps it is the case that.
Yeah, exactly. If it's entangled,
then potentially. It's a quantity that can be updated by virtue of just gaining information elsewhere.
So I just want to get a bit of a feel of how general you are when you do resource theory. So in the examples that you gave, the flavor was always, okay, take a branch of physics, for example, thermodynamics, and translate the terms that are being used there into a new language that kind of resembles a little bit of what people use in information theory, and then use perhaps information theoretic results to gain new insights. Is there a theory, or do you think that would it be possible to have a theory that kind of lifts this generality even up a level and talk about resource theories as a whole? So kind of like a, I don't know. For example, theorems along the lines of let R be a resource theory, then R has the following properties, along the lines of here's a classification of all of the equivalence classes of equivalent resource theories and things like that.
Yeah, so I do have a project of that flavor. So Tobias, who's sitting here, and I and Bob Kuka are trying to do exactly that, sort of say, you know, what's the mathematical framework in which it's, you know, you can describe resource theories. So, you know, we start with, you know, just a category of processes. So it's very general. It could be classical physics, quantum physics, but it could also be, you know, computer programs. You know, they're a resource theory. If, you know, this subroutine, I might want to economize on how many times I call it, whereas these subroutines, they're fast. I'll call them as many times as I like. So there's sort of this generic framework that we've been working on, and you know, we'd like to come up with some, you know, very general results. So far we have just a few, but I would expect that there'd be some very general results that might say, for example, oh, if you have catalysis in your resource theory, you know, that something can be, a resource can help make certain transitions possible, then you also have this other phenomena, for example. We are doing that, and I think category theory is the right framework in which to describe it. Although, you know, Tobias has pointed out that by focusing in on just the quasi-order of the states, so that's a partially ordered monoid, you're able to describe more resource theories. So, you know, it's not just resources theories that are of the sort I've described here, but a more general set. So you sort of you lose some of the structure, but you have more generality. So there's a few different ways you can do it.
Part of the view that prevails in thermodynamics is that entropy increase is not only a necessary condition, but a sufficient condition. You've been stressing that it's a partial order and no single suit, but shouldn't it, either they're wrong or there's some sort of limit of your theory, some macroscopic limit or something, in which entropy would be both necessary and sufficient.
Right.
Criterion. So can you say anything about the possibility of such a limit?
Yeah, so what's the only place wherein, you know, non-decrease of entropy would be a sufficient condition, you know, first of all, you have to be adiabatically isolated so that, you know, you really should be talking about the entropy rather than some other quantity like the free energy, as I was mentioning. But if you restrict the sets of states to a set that don't form a partial order but rather form a total order, so if I restrict all my states to be thermal at some temperature, then it turns out that there's just a one-parameter family of states that I'm talking about. And then they are totally ordered by the entropy. And then it's true that if I'm only talking about transitions among those states, yeah, non-decrease of entropy becomes a sufficient condition. But it's, to my mind, a very, you know, restricted context. And we, you know, shouldn't go around saying, oh, the fundamental rule is entropy shouldn't decrease, because it just it loses so much of the actual kind of structure of the problem.
That situation.
Yeah.
If you go beyond.
Right. So I mean, maybe. Sorry, I didn't mean to
miscommunicate on that front. I was saying, you know, one of the questions I asked in the beginning was, you know, what if we're not in equilibrium? You know, what if we're not dealing with all states that are equilibrium at some temperature, but states that are out of equilibrium? Then it becomes not sufficient.
Yeah. That's the kind of state that would have been considered in thermodynamics.
Note that.
Let me think about that for a minute. So you're saying, what if I have a state, two different temperatures? Well, I think this maybe is.
Okay, well, I have to think more about it. But I think this shows that perhaps from this resource theory perspective, talking about a restriction which would say your states are confined to thermal states at some temperature isn't actually a very well-defined theory, because as soon as I, you know, if I allow composition in parallel, then I can take two thermal states at different temperatures, say I have one tensor the other, and now that state on the composite is no longer a thermal state for the composite system. So it's sort of impossible to enforce the restriction that every system is thermal at some temperature and allow for systems to be composed in arbitrary ways. I guess maybe my answer was too quick, and I should instead say, well, those sorts of restrictions aren't really sensible. I think I should think about it some more.
Yeah. As you said, we only care about these dynamical theories and decision-centric. It's something that, as you said, we could think of more from an information point of view, an engineering point of view. But then you said that whatever we derive here must also apply for the fundamental one, so maybe we can learn something new for those.
Yeah.
Can you give one example where we learn something new for what you call the fundamental theory?
The idea, you know, maybe I don't understand your question, because I think I've provided a few examples here. So you might say, you know, having a version of another theorem for open system dynamics is a kind of a dynamical question. I have a system, I, you know, let it evolve with whatever its environment is, and as long as it has the symmetry, question, you know, what are the implications of the symmetry of that open system dynamics?
To distinguish a pure state from an open system from a closed system, it's kind of a technical tool that sometimes it's more convenient to think as a subpart of a system as being separating it from what we call a heat bath. But we know that the fundamental laws don't care about that. We can just consider the big system as some big state. So what are we learning about? Do you think the fundamental laws of physics do not like this point of view of just having some wave function that is evolving, and it's really conceptually important to separate open system from not open system? Right, from the point of view of designing a gadget that will align a spin and produce a spin and magnify a spin, I can understand. Of course, it can be useful. From the point of view of fundamental laws, do you think that quantum mechanics is not good enough up there?
I guess I'm not sure what kind of example would satisfy you, but let me try a couple of options. So, sometimes it's sort of not clear if you're looking at some complicated phenomena, you know, what parts of that phenomena are sort of about the fundamental physics and what parts are just about, say, our, you know, limited knowledge or something about us. So, you know, for example, all these issues regarding black hole thermodynamics seems to me as an outsider that, you know, some of the best clues that we have for, you know, how quantum mechanics and general relativity might meet come from the study of black hole thermodynamics. So all these issues about entropies and things that typically you would say relate to observers come in there, and you sort of have to disentangle them. So if you want to say, I'm interested only in the physics and I don't care about, you know, how uncertain anybody is about the state, well, you know, maybe you need to understand thermodynamics properly as a sort of agent-based theory to be able to disentangle those issues and get at the fundamental physics. So that would be one answer. The other answer is, you know, if I'm not talking about open system dynamics, so I'm talking about unitary dynamics for pure states, then to my mind, you know, if you have a basic principle like Noether's theorem, it always helps to sort of have a really deep understanding of that principle. What does it really mean? And so it's always sort of bothered me that, you know, all these kind of explanations I went looking for were kind of flawed. You know, they appealed to Curie's principle, and it's just wrong. You know, you can't motivate Noether's theorem in that way. And so what I mean by, you know, having an intuitive, you know, maybe a better way of saying having an intuitive feel for a principle is rather saying having a kind of theory independent notion of what the connections are between different principles. So those bridge lemmas I told you about that connected facts about asymmetry to facts about information theory, they didn't depend at all on the details of quantum mechanics. All they depended on was that, you know, you have some mathematical formalism for describing state preparations, for describing transformations of those states, some representation of a group on that space, and, you know, you can define symmetry relative to the transformation of the group, and then you can prove that lemma. So, you know, even if quantum mechanics is false and we have to replace completely positive maps on complex Hilbert spaces with something totally different, that lemma still goes through. And so if I could, for example, make a nice motivation for the conservation of the Noether quantities, you know, starting from this principle of information theory, going to something like a quantitative Curie principle, and finally making the link to the Noether quantities, and I could do it in a way that didn't rely on quantum mechanics at all, I think I would have some deeper insight into, you know, why Noether's theorem is true. And so if I could do all that, then I think that would be a good answer to your question.
But, yeah. Technology, you could understand if some differential equation could evolve from blah to blah. But this is very different, what you just said now. It's much more formal and at the level of concept rather than at the level of something that will tell you something like this physical theory cannot evolve from X to B. Right?
Yeah, it's
different.
It is a bit
the
different.
Goal is
yeah.
Different. It's not really.
It's harder than those easy applications I talked about. But this sort of general framework that Tobias and I are working on, I think, you know, provides a good mathematical framework in which to ask these sorts of questions.
So maybe we should call it at this point.
Yeah, sorry.
So let's thank Rob again.